Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes. Without the ads.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to Murder Mile, a true crime podcast, an audio-guided walk featuring many of London's untold, unsolved, and long-forgotten murders, all set within and beyond the West End. Today's episode is the first in a four-part series on Daniel Gonzalez. Dubbed the Freddy Krueger Killer, his two-day killing spree across London and the southeast of England left two injured and four dead. But why did he kill? Was he bad or mad? Murder Mile is researched using authentic sources. It contains moments of satire, shock, and grisly details. And as a dramatization of the real events, it may also feature loud and realistic sounds, so that no matter where you listen to this podcast, you'll feel like you're actually there. My name is Michael. I am your tour guide. And this is Murder Mile. Episode 135, Daniel Gonzalez, The Lost Boy, Part 1. Today, I'm standing in Tottenham Court Road tube station, W1. One street west of the Denmark Place fire, one street north of the murder or suicide of Freddie Mills, one street south of the Corner House Killer, and a few streets north of the diminished responsibility of Joe Ganane. Coming soon to Murder Mile. Under St Giles Circus, at the junction of Oxford Street, Charing Cross Road and New Oxford Street, sits the Tottenham Court Road tube station. Opened in 1900 as part of the Central London Railway, TCR intersects the Central Line, the Northern Line, and soon Crossrail, carrying almost 40 million passengers every year. Pandemic or not, a quick trip on the London Tube is a grim experience at best. With sticky seats, dirty air, and long lines of muttering morons, moaning about the next train being a whole minute away.
Oh God, it's a whole minute away.
The dizzying infestation of rats running along the tunnels, where they recently rediscovered the plague, is a nice distraction. But it's no more disgusting than the lady I witnessed cutting her toenails on the train. As with much of London's public transport, it's had a sad history of disasters, terrorism, and accidents. On Friday the 17th of September 2004, at 12:17pm, on Platform 4 of the southbound Northern Line, 24-year-old avid horror movie fan Daniel Gonzalez would be arrested. Having travelled 140 miles with an 8-inch knife, a Jason Voorhees mask, and a dream of being Freddy Krueger for the day, he had left a trail of bloody bodies in his wake. And although still keen to notch up a score of 10 dead and to be hailed amongst the pantheon of infamous maniacs, his killing spree came to an unremarkable end. As always, the tabloids drooled over every lurid detail of this gory tale, about his drugs, his knives, his method, and especially the blood. Fixated on the monster behind the mask, Daniel was branded as a maniac born out of pure evil, like Freddy Krueger himself. But what they missed was the true story. As it was here, following the arrival of two British Transport police officers, that Daniel's diagnosis was first taken seriously. But the question would still remain. Was he bad or was he mad?
I was bored. I wanted to know what it would feel like to kill as many people as possible. I felt wicked doing it. This is something I live for. It's a really good buzz. Killing.
On Friday the 17th of March 2006, at the Old Bailey, Daniel Gonzalez was convicted of the attempted murders of Peter King and Kumis Costantiano, and the murders of Marie Harding, Kevin Malloy, and Derek and Jean Robinson. Six strangers, chosen at random, and brutally butchered without an ounce of compassion. Having deliberated for 90 minutes, the jury dismissed any notion that his crimes were guided by a mental illness. As being in his right mind, he was found guilty of murder and nothing less. Judge Anne Goddard would later state, "You have brought unspeakable misery and grief to the families of those you have killed. You killed four people, and on each occasion you went out to kill. You armed yourself with a knife. You chose who to kill and where to kill, in places where there would be no witnesses. In my view, this is a case where life should mean life." Daniel was sentenced to six life terms, one for each victim, with it later extended to a whole life tariff. And throughout his arrest, investigation and trial, Daniel relished in his glory and showed no remorse. Upon his conviction, Daniel's mother gave her condolences to those her son had murdered. But rightly, she criticized the injustice she had witnessed time and time again. As every time we asked for help, or Daniel did himself, we were told we would have to wait for a crisis to occur. But by then, it was too late. June 21st, 1980, Frimley Park Hospital in Surrey. Daniel Julian Gonzalez was born. His birth was fine, his weight was right, and there were no major medical issues. As starts go, his upbringing was ordinary and uneventful, being a healthy, happy boy to Leslie Savage and her husband Julian Gonzalez. Home was Southwood Avenue in the village of Knapp Hill in Woking. A ring of post-war homes with neat gardens, sloping drives, and surrounded by country walks and golf courses. In 1986, when Daniel was six, his parents separated and later divorced. But keen to give his life stability, they kept it amicable. Leslie remarried. Stephen Harper became Danny's stepdad. And although Julian moved back to Spain, this father and son remained in close contact. Problems began in nursery. Being bright, he lacked the social skills to interact. But Daniel was different. As his mother would later state, he was extremely intelligent, but extremely disruptive. He could be absolutely charming, but also very manipulative, which some put down to him being an only child. At primary school, he excelled. But becoming more insular, he regressed inside his own mind and spoke to no one, except himself, his imaginary friend, and the volatile fights he would inflict on his mum. For Leslie, the warning signs were there. I didn't know something was going to happen, but I was scared. At secondary school, his first mental health assessment was conducted by an educational psychologist who diagnosed him with dysgraphia, a learning disability affecting his ability to write, which didn't explain any other symptom. November 28th, 1996, Daniel was referred to Frimley Children's Centre in Camberley. But he wasn't given a psychiatric assessment at that time. Instead, he was seen by a social worker. It's easy to dismiss his doctors as incompetent. But as an inquest would later state, his illness was atypical, and the lack of acute episodes or consistent symptoms made diagnosis difficult. In his teens, he was troubled, but he wasn't a monster. He had issues, but he could be as ordinary as any other boy. Which is why the murder trial revolved around one important question. Was he bad or was he mad? With no routine, Daniel's mental health declined.
I haven't had a job in 4 years. I haven't had a girlfriend in ages. I couldn't handle growing up to be a man. I just couldn't take it anymore.
In 1997, he had two attempts at employment organised by his mum, a job in a bank and a Blockbuster Video. But the longest lasted a week, as he couldn't concentrate and often got exasperated and angry. To fill his hours of solitude, as many teens do, he played football by himself, he glared at his PlayStation from dawn till dusk, and he took recreational drugs like cannabis. As he said, it kept him calm. But years later, as his need grew, he began to abuse skunk, LSD, ecstasy, cocaine, and amphetamines. With music and movies often blamed for the downfall of youth, Daniel listened to doomcore, a dark ultra-fast techno full of violent themes, sinister tones, and a heart-paralyzing 500 beats a minute. As well as watching slasher films like Nightmare on Elm Street, Friday the 13th, and Halloween, where a masked knife-wielding essence of evil stalks his screaming victims. But then again, who doesn't have an unhealthy obsession? Age 16, he committed his first criminal offences, including shoplifting and assault, during which he bit a bus driver's ear. In October 1997, he was placed on a 2-year probation order, and having said that he was hearing voices, he was sent to a drugs counsellor. But unable to diagnose his condition, they resorted to clinical default, and Daniel's symptoms were blamed on a drug-induced psychosis. In April 1997, with his exasperated mother struggling to cope with a fully grown, physically strong, and wildly unpredictable son, being at her wit's end and with very little help from mental health services, Leslie took a brave decision. She placed her son with Mr. and Mrs. Sloan, a foster family who were trained to deal with his psychotic behaviour. And later, he was placed with a new carer called Steve Price, who informed every necessary department that Daniel was at potential high risk of violence and or suicide. February 1998. Daniel was admitted under Section 2 of the Mental Health Act to an open psychiatric unit at St. Peter's Hospital in Chertsey, having harmed himself by punching a window. But before his assessment was even complete, he was discharged by a mental health review tribunal. After scores of letters and calls, in which his mother repeatedly pleaded, sometimes in bold capitals with the words, "I need help," Leslie was dismissed, ignored, and re-referred to another specialist. On the 22nd of June 1998, 6 years before his killing spree, in a letter to the Director of Surrey Social Services, Leslie wrote these prophetic words. Does Daniel have to murder or be murdered before he can get the treatment he so badly needs? Words she would repeat again and again and again. Wednesday the 15th of September, 2004. Day 1. Victim 1. 24-year-old Daniel packed his rucksack with a set of spare clothes, a Jason Voorhees-style hockey mask, and 2 5-inch steak knives, which he jabbed at the plastic washing-up bowl to gee himself up, muttering, Come on, boy. Come on. His motive was simple.
I wanted to kill as many people as possible. As many as 10.
And to see himself in the Serial Killer Hall of Fame. And as the prosecutor would later state, because of the callous person he is, it was his personality that led him to kill. Not a cocktail of drugs and alcohol. At 9 a.m, Daniel left Southwood Avenue, hopped on a bus at Knapphill High Street to Woking Station, caught a train to Portsmouth Harbour, travelled 49 miles south and got off at Hilsea, a coastal district at Portsea Island. Leaving the train at about 11:20 a.m, he walked 1 mile northwest to Hilsea Lines, a 19th century gun emplacement along Portsbridge Creek, a lush woodland full of leafy canopies, dark gullies, and narrow paths. 11:40 a.m. With his heart pounding, a steak knife gripped in his sweaty palm, and the 4 familiar voices inside his head spitting words, which he described as a drip, 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 like water torture. Each telling him to kill, 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 kill. His dream of becoming Freddy Krueger for the day was about to become his reality. Peter and Janice King were a couple in their 60s taking their dog for a walk. But to Daniel, their names were unimportant, as all they represented were the first 2 notches on his serial killer scorecard. Daniel entered the path, the knife at his side. And like his horror movie heroes, he stalked, he was silent, and then he struck. With the voices screaming,
knife.
Daniel lunged at Peter's face with the 5-inch blade, slashing wildly as he wailed, "I'm gonna kill you," at the unarmed man. Only Daniel was not the epitome of pure evil, like Halloween's Michael Myers, as his slashes were fast, but badly aimed, striking Peter's chin, but not his neck. And although 3 times his attacker's age, seizing his chance, Peter grabbed Daniel's hand, and the 2 tumbled into the undergrowth, only for Daniel to drop the knife and flee, shouting,
"Sorry,
I'm a schizophrenic. I can't help it," as he ran. Peter was taken to hospital. He received several stitches and was released later that day. The police attended the scene. They found the knife, but the fingerprints matched no one on their system. And as for Daniel's fantasy of becoming a serial killer, it came crashing down to earth with the voices silenced and his face smacking hard on the concrete of reality. But he wouldn't give up on his mission to kill as many people as possible, maybe 10. All he would need was someone more vulnerable. September 14th, 1998. Daniel's first crisis meeting, attended by social services, youth justice services, children's services, and the community mental health team. All agreed that Daniel was at a potential high risk of violence and or suicide. But a psychiatrist would state, "I felt that he was probably psychotic, but I didn't think that he was sectionable because of his lucidity and his lack of delusions." 5 days later, Daniel was sectioned. From the 28th of September 1998 to the 14th of April 1999, Daniel was committed to the Oaktree Psychiatric Clinic under Section 3 of the Mental Health Act, but later Sections 35, 36, 37 and 136, having beaten himself over the head with a saucepan. With his behaviour described as like a wild animal in a cage. Daniel was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia, treated with antipsychotic drugs, and opened up about the four voices in his head, who told him what to do, how to do it, when to do it, and why. They each had a name and their own personality. There was Katrina, Misha, Melinda, and Jenny Bean. His mother had seen it herself. "I knew he could see someone because he would look at them and talk. I would say, 'Daniel, what are you doing? Who are you talking to?' But he would always deny it." Over the last 2 years, Daniel had been diagnosed with four separate conditions, supervised by seven different doctors, repeatedly sectioned, discharged, referred, and trialed on a cocktail of psychiatric drugs. But finally, having been diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic, he was given the right medication, counselling, and regular support. He was weaned off recreational drugs, and he was making progress. Only once he was discharged, that consistency ceased. In his own words, Daniel told an inquest, "To have proper care, you need a doctor to follow your path and to cross-examine you thoroughly. If I was seeing someone two or three times a week, at least that's something." But he wasn't. As Leslie reiterated, despite our pleas, Daniel was left without the support he so desperately needed. "We did meet individual, decent, caring professionals who were dedicated and hardworking. But even they could not sustain any support over time, as Daniel was moved from one service to another." As for his medication, they tempered the voices and delusions, but every drug comes with side effects. These would include agitation, tremors, and muscle rigidity, which some patients describe as like living in a cocoon, barely alive, and to some, it's like being in hell. Dismissing his medication, Daniel returned to the recreational drugs which he trusted to keep him calm, as they didn't imprison him inside his own body. But any drug withdrawal comes with its own side effects. On separate holidays in Canada and Spain, his father and his mother both saw a boy in absolute mental despair. He was completely bizarre, scary. We were frightened to death. Without a regular routine or consistent care, his boredom returned, and he was back to square one. In August 2007, 3 years after the murders, an independent investigation concluded that Daniel was not treated successfully, health professionals never engaged with him effectively, and it was a case of missed opportunities. But as his illness was atypical and lacked acute episodes or symptoms, Northwest Surrey Mental Health Partnership would declare that as the murders were not preceded by a history of violence, therefore we do not believe that his actions could have been predicted. Which was true. His criminal record was short and insignificant. Theft, shoplifting, drug possession, non-compliance of community orders, and one case of burglary. Age 16, he had one charge of assault, having bitten a bus driver's ear, but his report showed no known violence since. He had no arrests for weapons, stalking, cruelty, arson, GBH, ABH or manslaughter, as would be expected. He had threatened others, mostly verbally, and his history of physical violence was predominantly self-harm. On paper, this was not a serial killer in the making. But the warning signs were there, and Leslie's prophetic words would come back to bite them. Does Daniel have to murder or be murdered before he can get the treatment he so badly needs? Wednesday the 15th of September 2004. Day 1. Victim 2. As detectives swarmed Hilsea Lines to investigate the motiveless stabbing of Peter King, Daniel caught the train to Fishergate, 43 miles east along the English south coast, and walked 2 miles northwest to Thundersbarrow Hill, a beauty spot of open fields and shrouded woods, on the edge of the Highdown residential estate. As before, he stood, he watched, and he waited.
I went to the first place I could go to kill someone.
But having been overpowered by his first victim, now he would wait for someone more vulnerable. ...73-year-old pensioner Marie Harding was a lovely lady. Described as the nicest, kindest, and dearest person you could imagine, she was a well-loved, die-hard supporter of Brighton and Hove Albion Football Club, where she worked in the club's ticket office and always had a smile for everyone. She was a loving wife to husband Jim, loyal mother to Julie, and a dedicated grandmother to Natalie and Daniel. As was her routine, having visited her family on nearby Oakdean Crescent, Marie was walking home. The day was sunny, fresh, and bright. It was the kind of day you would take a stroll in the woods. With his heart pounding, a steak knife in his palm, and the drip, drip, drip of four sinister voices splitting his head like water torture, as the small, frail lady tottered onto the secluded path, donning an ominous white hockey mask, just like his horror movie hero. From behind, he stalked, was silent, and then he struck.
I put my hand on her mouth and stabbed,
as the cold blade slid through her back.
She was screaming.
And as her bleeding body dropped like a dead weight onto the leafy path,
I slit her throat,
silencing her as he stole £20 from her purse. His callous logic.
It was a dead person. Why not take her money?
Only Marie wasn't dead, but dying. Paralyzed, bleeding, gasping for breath, she felt a numbness as a chill enveloped her and her cooling blood drained into the newly sodden soil. And there, this terrified woman lay, helpless, alone, but barely alive. Seeing her cowardly assailant flee into the dim distance, as the good life she had lived slowly ebbed away. At 4:20 p.m., a dog walker found the body of Marie Harding. But to Daniel, her name meant nothing. She was just a number. His first notch on the scoreboard, and his place in serial killer infamy. Thousands of football fans paid tribute to Marie with a minute's silence at their next game. Her family were devastated. Her town was in disbelief, and the police were at a loss. With no witnesses, no weapon, and very little forensics, all they had was a senseless killing by an unknown assailant, similar to the attack on Peter King, for which they had no suspect who matched the fingerprints or description. There was no denying, Daniel Gonzalez did commit this murder. At his trial, evidence included CCTV footage of his journeys, the tickets and travel cards he had purchased, his hockey mask, which was spattered with Marie's DNA. He made a full confession, and a key piece of evidence used to convict him was his diary. On the train journey home, he wrote,
"I will be a serial killer. I mean it. I promise. I will be a serial killer."
Writing of her last moments,
"I got that old bitch proper. Bloodbath. Pouring out of her throat, boy. McFlurry. I gotta say this. It felt really, really, really good. One of the best things I've ever done in my life."
3 hours later, Daniel was back home in Nap Hill, sitting in his bedroom, as seen by his mother at 7:15 p.m. At his trial for the murder of Marie Harding and three others, the judge would ask, was he mad or bad? And having been diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic, surely that answered the question. But was Daniel Gonzalez really a paranoid schizophrenic? Or as some medical professionals suspected, was this wannabe serial killer manipulating his symptoms and failures in the system to avoid prison? Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening to Murder Mile. That was part one of four of Daniel Gonzalez, The Lost Boy. As always, if you enjoyed that episode, stay tuned after the break for some cake, a cuppa, some waffle, and lots of extra details about this case. But before that, a true crime promo. Ooh!
Something is creeping, don't follow it down.
24 hours ago, I found out the person that I've been dating for the last 6 months is a con man.
That is my sister Emma. Andrew Tonks's lies had been so convincing, she'd invested $300,000 with him. However, the tables were about to turn on Andrew. What he didn't know was that Emma had discovered his real identity. But to get any chance of justice, Emma had to act like it was business as usual. Coming up in this series.
And that's when murder, all this stuff goes through my mind. I'm really, really scared.
I'm assuming Sarah has watched too much Netflix and figures I've been defrauding you. Couldn't be further from the truth.
That's what this was, a real life story that seems so unbelievable, but it was actually true.
A true story that all starts with one simple swipe to the right. I'm Sarah Ferris.
And I'm Emma Ferris. And this is my story, Conning the Con.
A big thank you to my new Patreon supporters, who are Absinthe, Linda Fife, Claire Gibson, Mene Luki, Sarah Pleitling, Amanda Sims, Queen J, Anne-Marie Griffin, Ricky V,
and Mark Dunstan. I thank you, the coots thank you, and even the greedy swans thank you. Plus a thank you to everyone who shares a link to Murder Mile on social media. It's not easy being a tiny little handmade independent podcast trying to compete with the big corporate giants who can afford to spend millions on advertising. So every personal recommendation is very much appreciated. Murder Mile was researched, written and performed by myself, with the main musical themes written and performed by Eric Stein and John Books of Cult With No Name. Thank you for listening and sleep well.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Frickin' hell, that was a biggie. Oh, dear Lord. Oh, cripes and lordy. Oh, boy, you can tell it may only have been 3 weeks since I've recorded an episode, but cripes. Oh, I forgot loads of things. I forgot setup. At the start, my microphone wasn't working. I couldn't work it out, and then I realised I hadn't pressed a button. Oh, all over the shop today. Oh, good. Anyway, but I hope you enjoyed that. Anyway. To people who are new, this is Extra Mile. This is the waffly bit where we have a little chat. We talk about stuff. Well, I talk and you listen because I can't hear you. It doesn't make sense, does it? Anyway, it's unedited. It's unscripted. It's not for everyone. It's not essential. You don't have to listen to it. This is the extra part of the show. You've listened to the show. This is the extra. But this is like the DVD extras. So, I'm just going to go on. Make another coffee because I need another coffee. It's an early start. I'll explain. I'm going to open some windows and doors. Let's do that. Oh, yes. Little moorhen going past. This morning the swans were knocking on my window going, "Oi, where's our breakfast?" Yesterday I had a lovely one, a little female mandarin. Which is very nice. Thank you to, I think it was Son of Gav who pointed out, I thought it was a, what did I think it was? I can't remember, some kind of duck thing, but he was like, no, it's a female mandarin. And I was like, oh, lovely, brilliant. But it was lovely, lovely little duck. Right, let's get some windows open. Oh, lummy. I've just got my kettle on. I'm just going to open these. Oh, it looks like it might be a nice one today. Looks like it might be a nice one to go outside and enjoy yourself rather than spending all day indoors editing this bloody episode, which is going to take ages. Got a note to self, Michael, water your lavender later on. The lavender outside needs a bit of a spritz. Just getting rid of the pillows behind my head. There we go. Right, coming back. Kettle's on. Today's cake, I decided to go for... Oh, I dropped it on the floor. Makes no difference because they're sturdy. Real Lancashire Eccles cake. Oh, look at those. Whoa, if you've never seen Eccles cake before, it's kind of like a How do they describe it on there? It's kind of like a nice... See, oh, to serve warm. I don't think I've had them warm before. Do not microwave, obviously. It's kind of like a nice kind of not so flaky pastry on the outside, and then inside is like raisins and shit. It's very nice, very lovely. So that's looking forward to that. That's my little treat. I'll have that with my quaffy. Light off, Michael. Save energy. I'm trying to be good. Saving energy. Lights off. I also, the other day, I realised, even though I've only got a little vanity basin on the boat to wash in, I realised that still takes 5 to 6 litres of water in the morning. I thought that's a real waste. So what I did was I went out and I got a little bowl that fits my head, and I put the bowl in the sink, and now, instead of abusing 5 to 6 litres of water in my sink, I'm only using 1 litre. It's amazing. Just these little kind of saving tips to save water and electricity, it all adds up. So what else are we doing? Thank you to everyone who enjoyed Meander Mile. That was just a little bit of... kettle's up. A little bit of fun to keep you entertained while I was away doing this, doing all the research for all these episodes. There we go. Lots of helicopters out today. Meander Mile. So I hope... there's lots of cases that we'll never hear about anywhere else on Meander Mile, and won't be coming back to Murder Mile anytime soon, as mentioned in the episode. So if you didn't listen to Meander Mile, I mean, it's your choice, but it's up to you. You've missed out on some cracking little cases and some interesting little stories. So, yeah. What else is going on? This weekend, very exciting. Got friend's birthday to go to. Looking forward to going doing that. That's going to be good fun. It's a fancy dress thing. It's got to be film themed. So I am going as Roger Moore in Moonraker, and I've made myself a little, a kind of a 1980s kind of astronaut suit. But I'm making a headpiece because there's a bit in Moonraker that I love. It's a bit antiquated, but Roger Moore goes looking for Dr. Goodhead, as he thinks. He goes to NASA. He goes looking for Dr. Goodhead. And he goes, I'm looking for Dr. Goodhead. And Holly Goodhead turns around. She goes, I'm Dr. Goodhead. And in his dinosaur way, Roger Moore goes, a woman? Because he's surprised. Because, well, you know, a woman educated in a job. Ooh, 007 dinosaur. So I'm creating a headpiece that you can wear that I can control with my hands. So when I say a woman, a fake eyebrow raises. Going to be making that later on. That'll be good fun. As you know, I went to see my dad and my stepmom. Finally, after 2.5 years, we got to see each other. We did a COVID-safe catch-up for a couple of days. That was nice to see them, to check on them, but make sure they're okay. Which was good. Weird to see them after such a long time. They'd aged, and I think I'd aged as well. What else is going on? I'm off to see my eye specialist today, which is why I'm up super early to record this. I'm a day early. This is the Wednesday I'm recording this. Because of lockdown, my eyes, because I have a degenerative eye condition, my eye specialist kind of quite rightly retired during the first lockdown. So I haven't had an eye specialist for about a year, but I decided to go private. I was like, fuck it, let's try private, because I couldn't get in anywhere and I needed an absolute specialist who knew exactly what my condition was. So I thought, well, let's try private. Let's see if they can get me in. They got me in with a week. They did all the tests. They referred me to a specialist in my condition. I got my notes within like 2 days. The other specialist got in contact within a day after that. And then he was like, when do you want to come in? I was like, as soon as. He was like, great, I'll get you in next week. So I'm in today. 2-hour appointment. Brilliant. And he's already kind of said what potential things that we can do. So it's very exciting, and it's not that expensive. I was surprised, and they don't seem to be palming me off with unnecessary stuff, which was what I worried about with private, because I thought they're going to make money. But both specialists I've chatted to have been like, you don't need this, you don't need that, I think everything's fine, da da da. So it's, yeah, very exciting. What else is going on? Murder Mile Walk starts this Sunday. Haven't done one of those in since last October. I did some in March before the pandemic, and then that all stopped, and then I did 4 in October, and I haven't done any since. So yeah, I've rehearsed, I'm ready, but a bit nerve-wracking, but Let's hope it's a nice one. Let's hope that not too many junkies are out to cause me trouble. Right, okay. Let's do a little quiz, then we'll move on with the extra details in this case. Just going to check that this is still recording. It is. Good. Question number one. Don't forget, as always, I might balls up some of these questions or I might edit them out because obviously you've just heard the edited version of the episode. I can't believe I have to explain to people that they've just heard the edited version. You've just heard the version I've edited, so some of it might be chopped out. And don't forget, as this is a multi-parter, as I go along, I might edit stuff out of part one and move it into part two. It just sometimes it helps the story better, or you know. So, question number one: what was Daniel's middle name? A slurp of coffee. Question two, nice easy one, I think. What was Daniel's mother's name? You can just have first name if you want. Question three, whose ear did Daniel bite? Question four, what age was he arrested for murder? Question five, name Daniel's brothers and sisters. Question six. What did Daniel stab the knife into on the morning of his first killing? So this is before the killing. Question seven. What type of music did Daniel like? Question eight. The path at Hillsea Lines follows a river called what? Question nine. What is Hillsea Lines famous for? I.e. what is there that people go to see? Question 10. What did Daniel briefly study at Brooklands College? There's some easy questions there and then some hard questions there. So let's dive into some extra details. Admittedly, this was kind of a case that I've kind of been umming and ahhing over the last couple of years about whether I was going to do it or not. Unfortunately, it's been kind of over-glorified in the press, who are kind of obsessed with the idea of, oh, the Freddy Krueger killer. Oh, he wore a Jason mask. Oh, he's... You know, they all use words like maniac, evil, mad, blah, 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 blah. You know the kind of shite that the classic tabloids do, where they can't be asked to do any research, but they want to over-glorify it. They want to have a kind of standout kind of front page, which has maniac kills. So everyone goes, oh, I must buy that newspaper. Because don't forget, people, it's not about news, it's about stories. They're trying to sell newspapers. So I almost didn't do this case. But when I started digging about, I found there was quite a lot about Daniel's mental health tribunal. There was an inquest into it. There was a lot of paperwork that I was able to track down for that, which was good. Kind of like with the Camden Ripper as well. I almost didn't do that case. But when I found the inquest into his mental health, I was like, actually, this kind of opened up a new world of information. So it made the case more interesting for me. Hence, this is less about the murders, who did the killings and who did do the stabbings and all that tabloid shite. And most of the shite that you'll probably find in anything that's written about this is going to be mostly about the mental health tribunal, because I think that's more interesting. So as mentioned with the start of this episode, I started in a reverse way. So we start with the sentencing and we show what Daniel was convicted of. He was convicted not of manslaughter, of murder. He was given six life sentences, which was later extended to a whole life tariff. So we will go. We've gone into, obviously, we've done the attempted murder on Peter King today, and we did the murder of Marie Harding. We'll dive into the others as we go through. But we've got a lot of more information about kind of Daniel's back history and his all the kind of inquests that happened around it and post sentencing as well. So used part of this in the episode, but at his sentencing, Judge Anne Goddard QC told Gonzalez at the Old Bailey, "You have brought unspeakable misery and grief to the families of those you have killed. Your actions have put fear into their lives. Your own family is also suffering. I have to pass a sentence of life imprisonment. You killed 4 people on 3 occasions, and on each occasion you went out to kill. You armed yourself with a knife. You chose where to kill in places where there would be no witnesses and who to kill. In my opinion, this is a case which means life should mean life, and it did. She also said, this has not been an easy case for you to listen to because of the events are so terrible. Her only option was to give him a mandatory life sentence, which basically, it ended up being a whole life tariff, which means he would never get parole. We'll dive into that later. Part 4 is when we kind of dive into the post-sentencing. At the start of here, I mentioned his arrest at Tottenham Court Road Tube Station. We're going to dive into that fully into episode 3. This is just kind of what I wanted to do with episode 1 was flag up what was kind of said at the trial. Because that's what's interesting about this case. There's nothing clear cut about it. It's kind of like he clearly is someone who has mental health issues, but the trial said yes, there's mental health issues there, but it was his desire to kill. You can see everything in his diary. You can see his obsession with horror movies, and you know there was the premeditation there. But this is what makes the episode, this four-parter interesting, is that we're going to cover all the different aspects of it to try, because I still don't think there's definition there. When we look at this, episode 1 is going to be focusing on the mistakes that kind of the mental health department said, and the fact that they said we couldn't have predicted this. Episode 2 next week, we're really going to be focusing on, not spoilers really, but we're going to be focusing on the fact that a lot of the kind of different mental health departments, kind of law providers, things like that, many of them kind of said he's using this as an excuse to evade prison. So we'll focus on that as well, because I think that's really important. Episode three is kind of the glorification and the use of kind of films and things like that. And, you know, and episode 4, we really dive into kind of what happened post-conviction, because that's interesting, because he can't leave prison anymore, he can't commit any murders, so surely if this was all fake he could just shut it off and go, okay, fine, he caught me, okay, yeah, I'm just pretending to be mental. But it wasn't. No spoilers, but it's an interesting case. I'm not going to come to a conclusion on this. It's but there's a lot to say. The voices in his head, he always referred to them as cool voices. They told him what to do. They're all females. Katrina, Misha, Melinda and Jenny Bean. He also said that the television would talk to him. I use this quote in the episode where his mum said he never denied the illness as whole. I've kind of cut it down. As an example, if I was in another room and he was in the living room, but I could see him in the mirror, so he wasn't aware I could see him. I could see him doing all these things, and she demonstrated kind of him grimacing with his face, and I knew he was talking. He could see someone because he was looking at them and talking and doing all these things. I would go in and say, Daniel, what are you doing? Who are you talking to? He would say, I wasn't talking to anybody. It was just a joke I remembered. He would always deny it. It was a moment of denial. It wasn't a denial of the whole thing. I can't explain it. What it boils down to in the end is that he did not want to talk about the voices. That was basically it. So they never really went there. So it was only really when he was kind of getting the psychiatric help that he started to begin to open up about the voices, and especially when he was arrested. The arrests, we're going to cover that a lot in episode 3, because that's kind of when he was arrested and when he was questioned by the police, and that's when he started opening up about things. But it's interesting. I don't want to give too much away, but it's kind of it's hard to decide who he is and what he's about. As mentioned in the episode, he had a couple of holidays with his family. His dad lived in Spain, so they went on holiday in May 1999 to see his dad for about 2 or 3 months, I believe. And another holiday in August. Now, he was off his medications at that point, but he'd started going back onto recreational drugs. But the problem is, when he went on holiday, he didn't have access to... obviously, he wasn't using his medication, but he couldn't get access to recreational drugs as well. And this is what his dad and his mum and also his grandmother saw at this moment. His mum said, certainly we knew 100% that he didn't have access to drugs. This is when he was on holiday. She said that there. When we went on holiday, he was completely bizarre, scary. We were frightened to death. In Canada at one time, we took him on holiday, and I didn't know at the time, he was definitely psychotic. Now, the problem is, getting your treatment, it is kind of a two-way street. You know, doctors can book you in for things, but you need to be kind of... attending these appointments and facilitating as much yourself as well. But the problem with Daniel, he kind of saw that recreational drugs was his way to kind of control it. As mentioned in there, he didn't like the fact that he was on what they call old traditional depot antipsychotics, which... Basically, it's a slow-release injection that they put it into your system and it slowly releases through your system as opposed to just taking drugs on a regular basis. But the problem is a lot of these drugs, as mentioned, have kind of really bad side effects, drooling, numbness, nausea, muscle rigidity, twitching. You may kind of feel better on the inside, but on the outside, your body is just it looks a mess and it is a mess. So as he was not... staying on those drugs and moving on to recreational drugs, he stopped having kind of a regular routine. They said over the next few years, so between 1999 and 2004, which we'll dive into probably more next week, he received really inconsistent care. He stopped and started treatments. He failed to turn up for appointments. And as mentioned, he was given conflicting diagnoses throughout and was pretty much left to fend for himself. As his mum would say, we tried and tried to get treatment, but we never got what we needed. It makes me so angry. It's like warning someone to wear a bike helmet before an accident. You want to say, I told you so. I'm not going to go into that bit because we'll probably use that last time. As mentioned, his mum repeatedly said every time we asked for help, we were told we would have to wait for a crisis to occur before he could get the help he needed. I did not know something dreadful was going to happen, but I was scared. This seems to be a consistent thing throughout that she's constantly saying, this is what makes... I think it quite interesting at the start is, the papers go, he had access to knives. He didn't have knives. They were his mother's knives that he got from the kitchen drawer. And they go, he had a Jason mask. He liked horror movies. He liked Doomcore. He had all these different kind of drugs. And they go, everyone should have seen that he was a serial killer. But look at his past. Look at what's in there. He's got minor convictions for shoplifting. He's got minor convictions for... I think he has one for burglary, which we'll go into next week, but that's much later. His convictions are minor. He doesn't really have assault. He has verbal abuse, some self-harming against himself, but he doesn't have a history of kind of going out and committing random acts of violence. He doesn't go... there's criminal damage in there, but it's not to people. So, it's easy for the press to go, you could see you as a serial killer. No, you couldn't. It's not there. If you take some of the information and you separate it and you go, let's use just this bit, but not those bits. Yes, you could say, look, it's clear. But I'm not trying to help out the mental health services here, but when you've been through kind of the various psychiatric institutions and you've seen various people in there, you can see some people and go, wow, they have the potential to potentially be, maybe serial killers or murderers or things like that. But with Daniel, it's just not there. There's just nothing right at the start that says he's going to brutally stab people to death. He's going to slit their throats. It's just not there. But unfortunately, that does happen with the paranoid schizophrenics. It can just take a moment. And with episode 3 as well, what we're going to do is, what I'm doing is I'm building up to the days before the first murder. So this episode we did the first murder, the next one we'll do the next one, and then we'll go on, but we'll do the day 2 days before the murder, which is significant. He doesn't attack anyone, but it shows his mental state. And I think that's really important. So that'll be part three. That's why with this story, I've got kind of a lot of it's kind of fast forwarding and rewinding through time. So it's worth keeping up with this. As mentioned, I think we've kind of covered everything with the attempted murder. So his mum and stepdad had gone out to work. He packed his rucksack. He put some clothes in there. Obviously, he was predicting that he was going to be blood spattered. So he was got some spare clothes in there. He got his Friday the 13th style hockey mask, which on the first attack he didn't wear. And a small black-handled steak knife, about 5 inches long. There were two of them, in fact, which he got from his mother's kitchen drawer. So he doesn't have his own knives, which you would kind of expect. If he had a history of kind of violence and things like that, you'd expect him to have his own knives. They're not difficult to get. Why he went to Hilsey, we quite don't know. Whether he went there before, it's a remote place. I mean, I'd heard of it, but I'd never been there, and I had to double check where it was on the map. Do you know why did he go there? We really don't know. Did he visit there kind of as a kid? These places are just so random. Even though he said he prepared for it, it just doesn't make sense. It's like, if he wanted to kill a lot of people, why not just go into the centre of London with a knife and start stabbing? Why didn't he go into Woking, the nearest town to him? You know, he went all the way down to the south coast. He went to Hilsey, but he was on his way to Portsmouth. Why not just go to Portsmouth? You know, a lot of this doesn't make sense. This is also something that we're going to be diving in later on as well. I think we've kind of covered everything with Peter and Janice King. That was the first attempted murder. As mentioned, you know, he was grossly overpowered with this. This just shows, you know, he decided to pick someone who he thought was kind of elderly. This guy was kind of, you know, only really 61. He was out taking a walk with his knife. Peter managed to grab Daniel's hand holding the knife, and then they wrestled to the ground, and then Daniel dropped the knife and fled. You know, it's these attacks will come back later on, so we'll be covering these a lot later on as well. Kind of what happened between 11:30 a.m. and the time when he killed Marie Harding, of which we still don't know what time she was murdered. We know that she was found around 4:20 p.m. But it was never really stated what time they predict that she was murdered, because she was bleeding to death. They don't quite know what time exactly she was attacked. It could have been anywhere between kind of like 12 and 3-ish. We know that Daniel made it back home at 7:15. He was in his bedroom, and the journey back from Highdown, which is where he was, to his home is about 3 hours. So it must have been pre 4 o'clock, because he was found about 3:20. We will return to some more about this. Oh, I'm not going to cover too much about this. We'll cover back in later episodes about his diary as well. I'm just being cautious not to tell you too much at the moment, because, you know, there's a lot of details which will be coming back to again and again. And because I haven't written episodes parts 2, 3, and 4, I don't want to kind of balls things up now by telling you stuff that will kind of be, you know, I don't want it to be a spoiler. But his diary is really important. It's kind of interesting that he did keep a diary. And I think that this was really used as part of the key evidence in his trial, showing his motivation, that he did want to be a serial killer, that he wanted to try and kill up to 10 people, that he had got a knife, that, you know, his thoughts, there was no compassion shown by him throughout any of this. So you can see why he was charged with murder as opposed to manslaughter, and, you know, why they said, you know, this was all premeditation. You did this. Therefore, you're going to go to prison for the rest of your life. Slurp of coffee. What did I put in there? That tasted a bit weird. I think that's it. I think that's all I'm going to tell you on this episode. Let's do the answers to the questions. And then I can start editing and then head off on a lovely day, head off to my eye appointment. Ooh, joy. Answers. Okay, question number one. What was Daniel's middle name? It was Julian. Julian. Question two. Easy one. What was his mother's name? It was Leslie. Surname Savage. Question three. Whose ear did Daniel bite? It was a bus driver's. Question four. What age was he when he was arrested for murder? 24. Question five. Name his brothers and sisters. That was a trick question. He was an only child. Question six. What did Daniel stab the knife into on the morning before his first killing? It was a washing up bowl. Question seven. What type of music did Daniel like? He liked doomcore. This is something that the press love going on about. They go, oh, he listens to doomcore and it's full of all or dangerous themes. And, you know, the beats like house music has beats of like 120 beats a minute, but this is like 500. Oh, God. Therefore, he must be evil. Twats. I'm sorry, I just hate this generic kind of shite when people use words like evil, mad, maniac. I think it's lazy. I think anyone who uses that just can't be asked to do the research into the background to go ask the questions. Why is this person doing what they do? If you just say lazy, bad, evil, mad, fucking forget it. You're not a true crime fan. You're just the kind of person who reads tabloid shit. Ugh, sorry. Question eight. The path at Hillsea Lines follows a river called what? It's called Portsbridge Creek. Question nine. What is Hillsea Lines famous for? It's a 19th century gun emplacement. And question 10. What did Daniel briefly study at Brooklyn's College? It was Spanish and drama. Although possibly I've edited that bit out because it may not be important. Good. That's me done. Hope you enjoyed that. That was a bit of fun. Oh, I've got a lot to edit. That was a really long one. Hope you enjoyed that. We shall be back next week with part two of four. There's 15 episodes in this season. This part of the season, unlike people like Wondery who only have 6 to 8 parts in their season, Murder Mile has a whole year, but broken up by little bits to do me a little bit of research. So there's 15 bits in here, and then I'll do a kind of a three-parter in kind of middle of October as a break to give me a chance to do the rest, and then we'll end with eight episodes and probably a big four-parter as well, so which I'm researching at the moment. So hope you enjoyed that. That's the end of Murder Mile. Have a good day. Stay safe. Be good. Lots of love. Stay safe. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want to get a chiseled look in the jawline? Sculpt and shape your jawline with added volume from Juvederm Volux XC. Juvederm Volux XC is an injectable gel specifically designed to be robust enough to improve moderate to severe loss of jawline definition. And it is the first and only hyaluronic acid filler approved for the jawline. Add volume to your jawline for a chiseled look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you. Visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.